Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Oh, yes, Chef listeners, how are you? Good, good, good. Today we are speaking to the most fabulous man himself, Mr. Andrew Clark.
Andrew looks after St. Leonard's in Shoreditch as well as Brunswick House, and it smells of fish in here, doesn't it?
I know, let me just set the scene. Me and Benny Boy and Kiro, the producer, we're in Shoreditch. It's a cold Tuesday morning, just about 9:30, beautiful day. We had a little latte and I had a custard bun, controversial.
You love that custard bun.
I do love
bun.
A custard bun. And then some guy just came in and Kieran just turned around at me and went, smoked fish. So yeah. So anyway, you're going to be in for a little treat today. So took yourself up, took yourself in.
Let's talk to the big man himself. All right, Andrew Clark.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay, yeah.
So this is nice, this private dining room.
It's quite fun, isn't it? It's like sitting in a... It feels very medieval with these like white red drape curtains, lots of logs.
That's the vibe I was getting. Big, yeah. Medieval kind of...
Did you design this?
No. Well, we used a company called Fabled Studio to do all the design for the restaurant. And they kind of came up with the idea, and we paid them for the initial drawings, and then kind of took that idea and played with it ourselves.
Okay, so you get to put your own spin into
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. We gave them a good brief as well, and I think one of the key details was like we want something kind of monastic, and so there's a few little church vibes here and there, something slightly medieval. I think this room could do with a few animal pelts and stuff like that. We'll go full Viking in here.
Yeah, more blood.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just like lots of ale everywhere. Yeah.
I've got a little gang called the Dangerous Dinner Gang, which was the name of our WhatsApp group. And it was just really about me and my mates. You know, whoever's out, we just jump on the group and say, hey, who wants to go and have some dinner? And then it became a thing, like, you know, with an Instagram and...
People wanted to be on the WhatsApp group.
People wanted to actually join the gang. It was like, how do we get into this gang? It's like, well, just make your fucking own up.
I want to be in the party.
How often does this happen? Is it a weekly thing? Is it a monthly
thing? It's kind of a monthly thing, yeah. And we were doing little events and, you know, barbecues and stuff like that. And there were chances for people to come down and hang with us and, you know, just eat some food and whatnot. But I think we might do a little bit more with it this year. We've got a really cool little logo and some merch and stuff. So
fun with it.
But I tend to be, I don't want to be like a leader of the thing. I guess it was something that I instigated with a couple of other friends. But at the same time, I just like being there rather than actually.
But then you've become the leader.
Yeah,
you are sat ahead of the table
at the moment. Yeah,
we're just banged up the end of the table, by the way.
I can see down, I can see what's going on.
It sounds like
door.
My mum's got a similar group, and they're called the Thursday Girls.
Oh, yeah,
and it's more like a neighborhood thing. You know, everyone in the street goes to a house every Thursday, they have a raffle,
nice.
Where you could win, like, you know, a
bottle of blue nun,
tin peaches, mushy peas. I always ask her, what did you win in the raffle? And sometimes she wins the same thing that she brings to it. Takes
that's
a
not,
tin,
that's
tin
not a good
features,
vibe, that. You've been gutted,
comes back
you?
With a tin of features.
Should go to the Wednesday crew. So tell me about this. So what kind of dinners do you have here? Do you get to? Do they make you cook or what?
Well, look, you know, I mean, we use this room as a private dining room. and we have like a good big set feasting menu. So when it came to the Dangerous Dinner Gang coming in, it was just like, you know, where should we go for our December
Christmas party meal?
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, well, let's just make use of this room. So I put the menu together, the boys in the kitchen cooked it all, and I just sat there and enjoyed myself. And it was just, it was such a delight over Christmas, you know, lots of big kind of beeswax candles, and it was nice and warm in here.
Very rare for you to go out for Christmas, for a Christmas dinner when you're a chef.
Well, I was kind of on site. I mean, you know, yeah, I was going to say, I'm down in the kitchen.
Technically working. Yeah.
Busman's exactly. Holiday, not fair.
And, you know, anytime I have meetings and bits and pieces, that, and even podcasts, then it's always like, come and do it at the restaurant, because I can never really leave this place. Do you know what I mean?
You're a busy man then, because you've got a lot of things going, a lot of plates spinning, haven't you?
Yes. I have tried to slow it down this year, just to focus on the things that, you know, really make, you know, that I really want to be doing. I think that there was a point where maybe 2 years ago, I was traveling all over Europe, doing a lot of cooking events, guest chef stuff. And it's kind of the quantity over quality. And this year, you know, with I want to be more at St. Leonard's and focusing on getting this place to where I believe it deserves to be. And at the same time, I've got Pilot Light, which is my mental health campaign. And we've spent the last year kind of dotting a load of, you know, getting a load of pieces together so we can really launch it. And it's it will have it'll be a very user based website and support for businesses, chefs, or just anyone that has kind of mental health problems that need advice and, you know, coping strategies. So it's quite, it started off as a very small thing, and it's become something so big that even confuses me how much that we can do to it. But I've got a good team that kind of picked it up and taken it to the next level.
So that must be pretty exciting.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, I can't wait to get it launched, because it feels like it was an idea that just came about. But, you know, as I dug around, it was like, wow, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg as to what can be done. So having a really good support team, and it was actually Time to Change, which are a campaign of Mind and Rethink, two of the biggest like mental health charities in the country. So they've said, look, you know, let's pick this up for you and get it working. So it's coming together really well. It's nice.
And then that, and Brunswick House, and Jim's Cafe, and everything else. It just, it seems like, I don't know, it's like spinning the plates, but really, yeah, really good things. Really,
well,
I
stepped away from Jim's. We launched it as a pop-up originally, and then one of us kind of took it over on his own. And I stepped away to open St. Leonard's. Brunswick House is in a very good spot. And, you know, fortunately, I need to go down there like once a month. But we've got a really good team. They run it so well. So it allowed us to do this. You know, if that was in a bad spot, then we wouldn't be opening anything else.
So do you find it frustrating to say no to things, because you kind of, you know, you've got the idea that you want to really concentrate on certain things?
I think now that I just feel, I'm kind of a bit tired. I say no to a lot of stuff, because actually I'm just, and it's not, it's just actually I'm too tired. I don't rest up.
There's not enough hours in the day.
It's not. And I only end up bitching and moaning about stuff when I'm overworked anyway. And I don't want that negativity to creep in. So it's just better to say, look, you know, at the moment I'm not focusing on anything other than St. Leonard's and the charity.
Yeah.
And a book.
Get a book.
Yeah, just do that in the morning. Do that in the morning. Do that in my 20-minute break. I'll stand up and have my sandwich, and I'll keep on going on the book, eh?
I think it's just like do it subconsciously while I'm sleeping, you know, like automatic writing, you know.
What, book or like cookbook or
cookbook? Yeah. Cookbook. A few anecdotes in there, you know. Alan Partridge style ones.
Excellent. Yeah. Nice. You can't fail with them.
No, not at all. Well, they make me laugh.
Absolutely, they make me laugh.
And me. Right, Benny boy, come on, let's get in there. Let's go right back. Your first food memory.
I'm going to say jelly deals.
See, this is something that I didn't see till I was 18. As a northern man, I just thought it was a myth.
Right.
But then, obviously, tell me about it, because like, it's one of those things that you only see in Only Fools and Horses where I'm from. So I didn't even know it actually really was a thing.
All my family are from like Bermondsey and Peckham, like the old Kent Road. And even though I was kind of born and raised in Dartford, between, you know, southeast London and you know, that top part of Kent, that, that was kind of my stomping ground. And, you know, growing up with both sets of grandparents, they kind of looked after me a lot. They loved their old school food, you know, pie and mash, jelly deals, that kind of stuff. So I grew up eating very shit sandwiches, like, you know, lunch tongue and corned beef, which I love to love this day. Yeah. And
it never goes away. It never goes away, the love for corned beef. I don't know why. Corned beef for corned beef.
Why can you never find corned beef sandwiches in any shop?
I don't know. I just think people think it's a bit dodged now. We're tinned. I don't know, but I think it's great.
I love it. I mean, I finished off a packet at home last night. So good.
So good. Sandwich of choice.
So soft.
Yeah. Ketchup.
And shit bread. It has to be shit bread. Yeah. Like, I mean, people have tried to make me sandwiches with, you know, even like really shit hams, shit ham occasionally, and really thick spread butter. I like it in like really crappy plain white bread. And then someone made it once for me, thinking, you know, do the chef a favour. But use sourdough. It's like, nah, you're missing the point here.
I threw the bread away. Corned beef from Kingsmill, mate. You know what I mean? 50-50, no thank you.
Kingsmill seems a bit too posh for me, to be
really?
Honest.
Really? You're going proper?
Really like Tesco's value.
What value? Bottom shelf bread?
Bottom shelf bread. I mean, it's full of all additives. There's probably no flour in there anyway.
Lasts for about 8 months. If you put it in the fridge, honestly, it will not go moldy.
No, you're absolutely right. I bought this. It's like a half loaf from my little corner shop. And I looked just to see, you know, when the date was. And it goes out in sometime in like mid-March, which is kind of worrying, really, isn't it?
Fresh bread served daily.
Bread lasting a week. It was a miracle once upon a time. And now it's lasting a couple of months.
Unbelievable. So go on. So these jelly deals, tell me the crack. So where were you eating them at? Where were you in the shops?
I was recently down in Margate, and I hadn't been down there for maybe 15, 20 years. And I said to the guys that I was visiting, I pointed to a little shack and I said, I have a memory of sitting on a little bench outside a little seafood shack eating jelly deals with my granddad. And the girl that lived down there, she's like, that's actually still there, that little seafood shack. And so even though it was a vague memory, I was totally right about the location. It just came to me in a split second. So, maybe I have got earlier memories, but that was one that was so distinct. And at the time, as a kid, I loved jelly deals. Then I went through a phase of hating them. And now I just love them, you know, and have done for some time. But as a kid, what a weird fucking kid I was.
Jelly deals.
Oh, the worst one I used to do as well. I'd have black pudding sandwiches as a kid and go to school because it was pig's blood. And I was just like, you know, it had to be fucking weird and different. So I'd have like this thick cut black pudding in a sandwich. I didn't even know you could cook it until I was 18.
What?
So this was like, you know, just dry black pudding.
Jesus Christ. So it was just raw black pudding in a thing. Yeah, amazing.
I've not tried that. It must be quite thick. Like you must swallow after 10 minutes of chewing.
It really is, because unless you cook it, cooking actually softens it. But when it's just straight out the fridge.
A lot of ice to work for the butcher for a bit.
I think it's worse than peanut butter, isn't it?
First day I worked as a butcher with this guy called Pepsi when I learned to make sausages. He was just there cutting the black pudding and then just eating it raw. And I was like, you can do that. It's like, yeah, of course you can. So there's just me and my mate and him just stood there, just eating this black pudding for 20 minutes. I was like, why do I feel a bit weird?
Well, essentially,
I've eaten about 2 pigs worth of blood.
Well, it is. I mean, it is cooked essentially, because you make the mix up and you poach it, and then that's what sets it. But yeah, I guess that product is still considered slightly raw when you don't get all the benefits that you get from actually cooking it and, you know, softening the sausage itself, that nice crispy layer, the fat kind of melting out a bit.
Keep saying that.
Yeah, right. Keep going. We're having a fire up in our brain. Yeah. So who was the cook in your house growing up then?
My mum mostly. My dad likes the kid that he was, but it was always my mum. Weirdly, I was having a conversation with my dad about this the other day, but you know, growing up, I was subjected to a lot of pasta because my dad was opening. My dad designed a lot of restaurants back in the day, and he did a lot of old school Italian places like Spaghetti House and those kind of things. So he was always around Italian produce, get loads delivered to us, and it's one of those things. I just remember either having pasta salads, which would be made with like farfalle, cold farfalle, and then like, you know, raw onion, raw peppers, which are, and maybe some tuna, which as a kid, those are fucking raw ingredients. They're not nice. No kid wants raw onion.
Do they?
Especially
after it burns.
Exactly. And the thing, and I can't stand this to this day. It genuinely makes me like heave a little bit. It makes me feel ill, is spaghetti bolognese. Like, I cannot stand the smell of like minced beef frying away, or not even frying, kind of too much in a pan and steaming.
Watery.
I can't stand that. So please, if anyone wants to invite me around the house, don't cook me spaghetti bolognese.
So then that was the bad dish. What was your mum's trademark?
Over time, I obviously learned to appreciate my mum's food. and no more than now. I mean, you know, as a chef, we just don't get people cooking for us enough. My mum's signature dish these days is definitely pulled pot. It's always like a, you know, she'll do it twice a week sometimes in terms of getting a big pot, stick a chicken in there, fill it up with vegetables, and you know that will last a couple of days. When it's gone, stick another one on. But you know, it's, as a kid, it got me out of, or you know, a teenager in my 20s, it'd get me out of a few hangovers. And yeah, it's a shame they live not too far away, but I just don't see them enough that I can, you know, run around there when I'm hungover.
Yeah.
Do they get to come down here then and visit you and see your cooking?
Yeah, my dad's always
place?
In town. I mean, yeah, they're only 20, 30 minutes down the road, but you'd be surprised how, when you're working a lot and lots of things on the go, it might be once every 2 months we catch up. But my dad's always in town. He does a lot of business in the area. So.
And he always worked in with restaurants, essentially. Is that what got you into it, type thing?
I think so. I mean, look, I never wanted to be a chef. I didn't actually think that... my life would be in restaurants in any way. I think for me, it was a bit of a subconscious thing that we were exposed to restaurants as children, me and my sister. And then we went to nice restaurants. I had a big appetite, so I'd always be curious about food, then try and go home and recreate it at some point. So, you know, as a 9-year-old, just standing over the stoves trying to do what I might have had in a really nice steakhouse or something. Failing epically, by the way.
We're trying.
Yeah, but trying, exactly.
Still having a steak at 9, though. We can't complain.
I'm thinking a steak. No, right. Knowing us, it was still, you know, offal of some kind, yeah. But I grew up on a lot of offal. And then, yeah, we were exposed to a lot of that. So I think in my head, at some point, I wanted to be a musician, but at some point I would have been, I would have made a little bit of money as a rock star, and then I would have had a restaurant just to... you know, sit in the corner with a bottle of claret and see the rest of my days out, you know, something like that.
That sounds ideal. That
does sound ideal. I think we've all tried that at one point in our life, haven't we? The rock star life.
Absolutely, yeah. So growing up, you know, you're eating jellied eels and stuff, right? And you're getting exposed to all this food. So would you say that your relationship with food was kind of positive and healthy? Or were you like a typical kid where, you know, vegetables are like a no-go?
I think I've always had a decent appetite and been curious. And I think the more extreme it was, then I would definitely go for that. I don't, you know, there were a lot of the kind of food memories that, and I don't blame my parents for this or my mum for it, but, you know, just having fish fingers, chips and tin sweet corn, and then not draining the sweet corn enough. So you've just got these kind of, this fucking sweet corn water that just makes everything that was crispy on the
dipping
plate.
Dipping your bread in it.
So it's just, you know, that kind of stuff I didn't actually like. So, you know, I know a lot of kids have that. It's a normal meal for people, but I didn't really like that. So I think I probably did appreciate better food, you know, good food, things that weren't out of a tin or, you know, frozen.
Well, offal as well. I mean, like that kind of thing when I was a kid, I remember kidneys and you know, and all this kind of, all that kind of stuff. I don't know, I don't see it as much. And my mates, when I go out their house, we're having Chicago Town pizza, and you're like, this is a treat for me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So you're used to having these really nice things. My grandma was like, corned beef hash, you know what I mean? Certain days, the traditional Friday things that cook, that, you know, like a steak on a Friday. Exciting times.
I was, my death row dinner would always be fish and chips. I mean, I love fish and chips. And so that was like my Friday meal. It was almost religiously. I think as a kid, though, you know, in my teens, that where I had a curiosity for trying new things, then I loved traveling, or I loved going on holiday and then, you know, trying to come back and recreate those dishes that we had abroad and obviously don't have the sun or anything else, but there is, you know, there was a curiosity about travel and food and how they relate. And I still have that, to be honest. I mean, I love traveling. I love trying dishes. And then, okay, how can we go back to the restaurant and like anglicize this, or, you know, make it slightly more European? So, yeah, I was definitely curious.
So what about at school? Because you must be in packed lunch there with your black pudding sandwiches. Yep. Was that like an everyday thing, or would you like change it up?
I can remember.
You made your own.
I didn't make my own, no, but I knew what I liked, and I think it was my nan that indulged that side of it. My mum would probably just make me, I don't know, ham sandwiches, cheese sandwiches, but that's about it. Maybe you'd get a yogurt in there and a packet of crisps. A Kit Kat if we
yogurt
were lucky.
Yogurt for dessert is definitely a younger thing, isn't it? When you're a bit younger, you're like, have a yogurt for after. You know what I mean? It's like, you wouldn't think of having it. You wouldn't think now of having a nice dinner at home with your missus and going, fancy a crunch corner, just to end it.
Do you know what?
You can have the jam, I'll have the plate.
I never actually, desserts weren't really a thing in our house. So I didn't grow up with a sweet tooth. And I think just to have a yogurt was probably more acceptable after dinner than
it was,
actually,
yeah.
You know, having a jam roly-poly or anything.
Oh God, I was jealous of going out to my mate's house, and they'd have, the mum and dad would have cooked like an apple pie, a jam roly-poly.
Yep.
It was just a yogurt or a biscuit. So after you've had dinner, you just have a blue ribbon.
A biscuit and just a wrapper.
Yeah, just literally a blue ribbon or them amazing, what are they called, with the marshmallow.
Oh, yeah, the tea cake.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus Christ. They're a tea cake afterwards. It's like, delicious, aren't they? Oh, they're unbelievable.
The Tunnocks range.
Tunnocks, I mean, have got the caramel as well.
Always have caramels at home.
But just, it's the wrapping as well.
Yeah.
I think because I'm from Cumbria. So it was near Carlisle, I think, Tunnocks was from. Oh, maybe it's Scotland.
Scottish.
Yeah, Scotland. Yeah, oh, right up there. Scotch Corner. I was thinking Scotch Corner halfway there. But I just remember in a Tunnocks afterwards, and when I used to go walking up the hills, we'd have a tea cake at the top of Coniston Old Man. And that's the only reason I was there. Just a fat kid who just wanted a Tunnocks. Do you know what I mean? The little treat at the end.
I tell you, I bought some fake caramels from Lidl.
Oh, nice. Caramels.
They're like a caramel biscuit, you know. And everything about them is proper, but the fact that it doesn't really come in the paper wrapper, it's just like, nah, you've lost me.
Yeah,
so
it's not as
they've
interesting.
They've sat uneaten for about 2 months, and I keep stocking up on the Tunnocks ones and stuff. You can't cheat the original. No, you can't.
Not at all. Yeah, I'm just thinking more about jam roly-poly now. You've done me.
it's a great dessert, isn't it?
I mean, obviously you haven't got a sweet tooth. So when you went into food, do you ever think about desserts, or did you just go, that's not me?
I had school dinners. I love school dinners, and I would have a dessert then. I mean, if it was jam roly-poly, for me, jam roly-poly, cold custard on it.
Mm.
I can't have custard hot. It becomes too sweet. But cold, it's not as sweet, and it's just, I mean, jam roly-polies are fucking sweet, aren't they?
Yeah. Heavy kind of pudding, isn't it?
My granddad had a bakehouse, and obviously used to make roly-polies and the jam, and this, but they were huge. The full table, the size of this table now here, I mean, massive. And he'd set out the sponge, and I'd just be watching him at like 4, doing the whole jam for the whole thing. And then him and his mate would just roll it, chop the ends off, and that'd be my chef's treats.
Yeah.
Every day before school. So I'd go there and just collect bags of all this crap to take to school for me, Mitch, and like all the off cuttings of shortbread.
You were selling it at school, were you?
Oh, no, selling fags.
Like black market rolling polies.
Come and get your jam rolling polies. Come on, boys. Come on.
You got any of the good stuff?
What's he got today? Oh, my God. Vanilla slice.
The cake, man. Here he comes.
Here he is. Custard Keith walking up the street.
Custard Keith.
Right. Right, let's get back. So we've gone through school, we've gone all that kind of stuff. You talked about being, you know, wanting to be a rock star and wanting to do music and stuff and falling into it. Throughout that, so there was no kind of ambition of going to a kitchen. It was just music.
No, I left school, I did A-levels, and I just wasn't good at school. I mean, you know, when I kind of turned up, that I just sat in the back of the room kind of tired from being at a gig the night before or something. So I fucked up all my GCSEs. Done pretty well in A-level, by the way. But then after that, I left. Education was wasted on me. And, you know, I did a bit of session work on, you know, in the music community.
As a guitarist, right?
As a guitarist. And I kind of started building my own recording studio and had a couple of bands that I'd play with. And then where did it go? There was a changing point in my life where I was looking at life in prison, which as a 20-year-old, it was, you know, a 21-year-old, it's you know, quite daunting. And I had to earn some money, you know. So I ended up, as I had failed most of my exams and wasn't really good at anything else, the only thing that I had was kind of, you know, interested in and had a very, you know, small understanding of was actually cooking. So I got a job in a pizzeria, or a friend was working in a pizzeria, and he said, look, we've got some work down here. Why don't you come down? So I just thought, you know, if it's going to help my music, if it's going to, you know,
fund it.
Exactly. If it's going to do that, then yeah, I'll jump in. But, you know, no one ever told me that actually being a chef is not a good thing if you've got a few other, you know, a few other things on the go. It's just like, it's so consuming. Do you know what I mean? And I've been joking recently. It's like, you know, I walked into a kitchen 20 years ago to fund my music, and yeah, now finally I'm leaving now. Do you know what I mean? Just so I can, I play in a band now, and you know, hoping to do some stuff with that this year.
So, what age did you pick up a guitar? Teach yourself?
No, I actually took lessons. I was about 10, 11. Yeah, I was terrible for the first few weeks.
So, what were you listening to at 10?
Guns N' Roses,
all the way.
It was. I mean, you know, I think Terminator 2, the soundtrack, You Could Be Mine, that came out. And I saw this video and I was like, what the fuck is this? You know, and that was it instantly. I wanted to play guitar. I wanted to, you know, be in a band, tour the world, that kind of stuff. The dream was lit then. And
10 years old.
10 years old. Before that, though, I think I wanted to be in the army.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I grew up wanting to be in the army. And then I found, like, at 10 years old, music.
It's a bit more fun, isn't it, yeah, at 10 years absolutely. Old, to look at the guitar and then go, actually, this could be a right laugh.
And then by the time you start, you know, that kind of got me into a whole genre of music. And then by the time I found, like, Bob Dylan and stuff like that, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to be a soldier.
Yeah, I'll stick to this, please.
Yeah.
Can you remember the first guitar you had?
Yeah, it was a really, it was like a Gibson SG copy. So it was a really cheap, almost homemade copy of like the guitar that like Angus Young from AC/DC and Tony Iommi. And I kind of miss that. I haven't had that shape ever since. I've got a lot of Gibson.
That's your treat when the book's out. It's got to be the little treat to yourself.
Literally every night I look at eBay.
Yeah.
I sat in bed last night in this eBay hole of what guitar would I buy next.
So yeah, so after the pizzeria,
yep.
What happened next? Because obviously now you're still in the funding the band stage, and I guess that happens for quite a long time. So what's the next step to something that's a bit more stable?
So the pizzeria didn't last long. It was terrible. And I just figured, look, you know, I don't want to be a chef, but I'm better than this. And I think the moment I saw someone pick up a garlic bread off the floor and put it on a plate, and so I was like, you know what, I'm out, I'm done. And I just went to like another pizzeria, but they had a wood-fired oven in this one.
This is
so
proper.
Like, you know.
Moving up in the world.
Yeah, it was. Well, for me, it was always a big deal. I'm like, you know, I'm leaving this place, but I'm going over here. They're serious chefs here. But I've got to be honest, it was my first bit of live fire cooking, where we had this lovely wood oven, you know, wood fired pizzas, but at the same time loads of these cast iron grills that you just heat up in the oven, pull them out, put a steak on it, back in the oven again. And it was nice. And it genuinely, for as shit as the restaurant actually was, there was a flavor thing going on where it was like everything tasted so much bigger and more amazing. So it was still bad produce, but it was a step up. And I think in the early days, certainly in the first 2 years, where I was a very reluctant chef, I wasn't taking it seriously enough to say, look, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go and, you know, go to, I don't know, Gordon Ramsay or someone. I was just trying to be better than the last restaurant that I was working at.
But you've still got the kind of the hunger to be better, right? Even though your priority is like music, but you're doing this to fund your music. So when was it like, I actually do want to be a chef and get into this deep? Did that stem from that, or was it like a natural thing?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I have a hunger to be the best at anything. I just like doing what I do. I just enjoy doing it. And some people say I'm a bit too humble in that sense, and I should boast a bit more about, you know, wanting to be the best. It's, I just feel that, you know, I'm very blessed that having a job that I wake up in the morning, I can, you know, it doesn't feel like work to me, even those 16-hour days. And when you've got the stresses of opening a restaurant, it doesn't actually feel like work. I come in, I enjoy myself, and, you know, I have an amazing team to work with. I just, you know, I think the challenges we have are the things like, you know, you want your restaurant to do really well and survive. And then that's where you have to be slightly competitive, or you have to, you know, try and be the best that you can be just for the sake of keeping the restaurant open as long as possible and having some longevity there.
And then, so you went from there, and then when did you start going into, you went work with firm Phil Howard, didn't you? You went to Swan.
The Swan in Westmorland.
Was that a massive step up?
It was, that was the place that engaged me in terms of everywhere before that. For 2 years, I'd kind of bummed around just earning money in a kitchen. That was it. By the time I got to the Swan, it was like, you know, things came in by the carcass. There was a lot of butchery. Once a week, we'd go up to the markets, Billingsgate, Smithfield, fill up a van, drive it home. And you'd do like a 3 a.m. till 3 p.m. Double shift.
God.
But it'd be a case of, you know, getting up early, picking everything up from the market that you've ordered the night before, come back, start prepping it all, putting it all away in the fridges, and everything's there for the line chefs to...
Exciting that though, isn't it?
Very, very good. I'm kind of... It's one of the things I'm actually in my writing at the moment. I'm kind of reminiscing a lot about, and they were very, very fond memories from that time of just...
Can we get into them a little bit, if you don't mind?
Of course,
it's exciting, because well, anything, jumping into any kind of job, any career, but when you know you're at a certain level working with someone that you look up to,
yeah.
Was that a change of seeing the different style of kitchen?
It was kind of a lot of ex-Marco Pierre White chefs at the Swan. And for me, I mean, you know, just seeing that how serious everyone was, and it was a big team. I was used to kind of, you know, old pirates and stuff, the people that, you know, just didn't really, you know, like myself, actually wasn't really taking cooking seriously. They just didn't have anything else to do. But then I got to the Swan, and it was like a real serious level of chef, and everyone was so immaculately dressed. You know, there was a real uniform going on, and to actually wear the uniform and feel part of that, I was like, okay, now I can consider moving into this industry and perhaps, you know, putting the guitar down for a bit.
And then, so when from there, I just keep thinking about driving to the butcher's at 3 a.m. I just think it's such an exciting, it's like almost like a privilege. It's like, I'm also a chef as well. Yeah. And then getting my stuff, sometimes you forget because you think, Christ, you text him at night, he gets it in the morning, it's done.
Yep.
I want to go there, I want to see it, I want to explore. And I think that'll inspire me. It must be inspiring to write the dishes that way as well.
Well, I think, you know, we progressed even more than that. That was a real step up. But going to Smithfield was good, but it was still a bit generic. I mean, these days, you know, and we certainly started that at the Swan, but it was actually trying to find farmers local that can breed things for you. And, you know, what we'd end up doing is, like, I was head chef by this point, and I had a little truck, and I'd get all the chefs in the truck during the lunch break, tear up one of the fields, go and see the farmer, and, you know, pick out a sheep. 2 weeks later, it's on your chopping board. So you're always thinking about the next, you know, thing that you, the carcass that you want in to work with. So that was, you know, that's when we stopped using the markets. It was actually trying to find day boat catch from kind of local fishermen that had come up from the coast, or, you know, local farms that would grow things for us, breed things for us.
And this was all your idea then? Was it getting them people rather going to Billingsgate and Smithfield?
Yeah, really. I mean, actually, we ended up cutting the team down quite a lot. So we didn't really have the chefs around, or anyone. Actually, it was mostly me, but anyone that could actually go up to the market anyway. It was quite a detour to go from Kent up there. So it just made more sense to try and, you know, source as locally as possible. And, you know, this is maybe 15 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. And I really got into foraging, and I was obsessed with it. So even in the mornings, like nice and early on my way into work, you'd be like just picking mushrooms, or lunch break, take everyone out. And, you know, mushrooms, chestnuts, weeds, all sorts. So it was like having so much... I know people make a real effort of trying to find everything within a certain mile radius, but actually it was just very easy for us to do that, and it happened by default.
And is this kind of experimenting with food then? Because if you're like just foraging and you get you know, whatever's kind of you come across, and then what, you just try and create something from that?
I think for us it was, yeah, we were just working with Forager, the company had just started, I think. So I was going out with those guys, reading a lot and, you know, understanding a bit more about what we had locally that we could use, and then just eating it and just trying to find out what does it taste like? And, you know, what would we normally do with, let's say it was something like Ditanda, which we found on the beach, and it tasted like horseradish. Okay, like, can we use it in place of horseradish on something that's, you know, you'd have horseradish with, you know?
Exciting. Just getting you right involved as well. Like,
yeah,
being in a city now, do you miss that a lot? The fact that you massively can't walk to work and eat a weed in Clapton, can you?
Well, do you know what? It's really funny, actually, because when I finally left the Swan and came back into London, that was about, maybe 10, 12 years ago. And I was working at a restaurant, and they were really proud in showing me things like sea purslane. And I was like, you know, I've literally collected kilos of this stuff. And then there was a moment where they were like, oh, can you get the chestnuts out of the freezer? And I was just like, what? And they're buying in like peeled chestnuts. And it was like, chestnuts, we'd find chestnuts if we couldn't find mushrooms. You know what I mean? The woods were littered with chestnuts. So it was kind of sad. And then when you're paying like 15, 20 pound a kilo for fucking stinging nettles.
It's free though. That's exactly. The thing. As well, like, from being from the lakes, like, sometimes I get so gutted that I can't have somewhere up there because everything's close. Butcher, is my mate's dad. Do you know what I mean? It's like your bread is your nana's mate. Do you know what I mean? It's like all that kind of thing. Yeah. Getting everything close. And obviously, you can pick it on the way to work and not pay £15 a kilo. No. And you've got something special.
Well, we had gamekeepers as well that, you know, used to come into the Swan a lot. And we were friends with them. So we'd on Saturdays, we'd go out beating with them and, you know, occasionally shooting. And, you know, once everyone that had been part of that shoot, that hunt, had taken what they wanted, everything else went to the restaurant, almost kind of free of charge. Do you know what I mean? We'd just do a big meal every year for them, like a gamekeeper's dinner. So that was all good. We got all that done. And then, you know, maybe going out lamping and shooting rabbits in the evening sometime.
Lamping. I've been only been once, scared the hell out. I didn't know what it meant. I would just thought, and then out of nowhere, then loads of these, you know, well, it was crazy. He had a ferret. I just remember some memory when I had to keep, like, my mate's dad had a ferret down his trousers.
That's a different story, isn't it?
No, honestly, he'd keep the ferret warm, put it down his kegs, and then ferret bun.
Got scared stiff when you stroked it.
It was horrible. I was like, hey, that ferret's grown. No, it wasn't that. No, honestly, he had a ferret down his kegs, and he chucked it. He lamped, set his dog.
Do you need to speak to someone about this?
Like, maybe.
Ferret down his kegs. Is there a helpline for that?
I think I told my mum I slept to my mate's house, but
is that why ferrets always smell of piss as well?
Honestly,
it's the place ferret, that people keep them.
Ferret man kept it down his kegs. I wish I hadn't said that now. Edit that one out, Keith. So where are we at now? Sorry.
Was there a moment where you've kind of got the confidence in your cooking? Because, you kind of progressed from these, like, pizza places where it wasn't really relevant. You didn't have the hunger for it. And now you've seen it. The change, and that's kind of ignite the spark in you. But was there something where you kind of get involved with yourself and you're like, actually, I'm good at this?
I think I was very good as a line cook, and, you know, the kind of chef, the party sous chef. It's like playing a game of football or being a footballer. You have a desire to be the fastest, the most accurate, you know, score all the goals. And for me, it was just like, by the time I was on the sauce section, and, you know, cooking the meats and sauces and stuff, and it was just like, you know, I wanted to be untouchable. You know, I'm going to be the best I can be on that section. And I still feel, I'm 41 years old now, so I'm an old man for, you know, compared to some of the young guys that are, you know, I employ. But it's like even being on the grill now, you know, it's like, come on, let me get on there and I'll show you how it's really done. And I try and just, you know, be that little bit better than everyone else in terms of the service. Knowledge, yeah, and I mean, that should happen after kind of 20 years of cooking, but it's the speed and it's the accuracy of cooking that I don't want to lose that. I think that's quite important. That period of being the one that, you know, I would be quite territorial about my section. I didn't want to leave those sections. I wanted to be on there, and that gave me a lot of confidence about what I did. I think by the time I was head chef, And then I'm on the pass. I'm actually, you know, I'm walking around with a fucking clipboard and all, you know, EHO forms and rotors and, you know, worrying about people's pay and stuff like that. And it's just like, it kind of sucks the life out of you, really. Unfortunately, it's just, you know, it's part of the process. But the sous chef years were my most fun, I think.
It's the rock and roll years.
It was. And you know what? I think when I left the Swan, I just wanted to go back into London and cook. And spend a year just cooking. And I went to the Anchor and Hope, and that's exactly what I did. I jumped on the stoves there, and again, very territorial about being on the main courses. And you'd do like, you know, there'd be two chefs to do 180 covers, and you'd smash through them.
That buzz must be incredible.
It's insane. Insane.
Tell me some stories. Because I always think, I've never been at that level as a chef at all, but when I've had friends and when I've seen things, it is that buzz and cooking the standard of food and keep the consistency perfect throughout the whole thing. It's a pride thing as well. I think a lot of chefs, it's about pride, and you are working a hell of a lot of hours, 12-hour shifts, 13-hour shifts. That's a small shift. And then you've got to then prep it, then smash it out. You know what I mean? It's that kind of like...
I think, you know, I love hard work, and I feel like a pig in shit when we're opening restaurants and... We have to spend like 3 months being in the site every day. And I mean, it's obviously not sustainable. You can't do it for much more than that. But for that period, there's, you know, such an adrenaline rush. There's camaraderie. There's so many things going on that make you think, you know why you do it. It's we were adrenaline junkies, I guess. Do you know what I mean? You know, we love the buzz of that. And, you know, the hard work thing, I obviously have a lot of things going on in my life, but I do feel it's my comfort zone when I'm actually in a kitchen. I've got a lot of butchery to do, loads of fish prep, create a couple of new dishes for lunch. So your mind's always thinking. But you actually, for as busy as you are, you can almost switch off the rest of the world. There's no other problems that go on. So it's weirdly therapeutic for me as well.
It's a little bit like the music thing, you know, because you've got this, you're creating something from the start, from the ground up. So when you first get it to a new site, you know, you've got to put that work in to build up to get it to the level where it's ready.
Yep.
You know.
And there's also the thing, I mean, you know, I think when we opened St. Leonard's, there was a buzz going around about, you know, Jackson and I opening a new restaurant. And the last thing I wanted was to be that another overhyped restaurant. I hate that myself, you know what I mean?
It's out of your control though, isn't it?
It really is. So I think that... particularly opening this, that was a thing that was like, okay, if we're going to be overhyped here, I'm going to make sure we deliver. And I think we have. I mean, there's so much room for improvement still. I think we let it dip a little bit when we took our eye off the ball, but I'm back in the kitchen this year and certainly for the next 6 months, I'll be here nearly every day just to, you know, lift it back up to where I think it needs to be. But it's like your baby. I don't have a family, so it's my only reference to having a baby. And you want to make sure that its early years are the best they can be.
Yeah, that makes sense, man.
So tell us about your relationship, like how you and Jackson decided to do that or work together. Because like you've been, like you're saying about how much buzz he gets off being in the kitchen. Mm. Like, you know, I've done that and then I've started my own business and it does it's a completely different game, isn't it? Because you're not there, you've got to take yourself away, you've got to do this and it isn't, you're not in control. And most of us are control freaks a little bit because we like to be there every day, seeing the past, seeing what's going out and it's hard.
I think I found it very difficult when considering opening this site that to then have like Brunswick House, then St. Leonard's and, you know, we had thoughts of a couple of other things. It's like there's a point where you're no longer the chef. You become the restaurateur. And I was like, okay, am I ready to kind of give up cooking? And it's not to say I'm giving up cooking, but it's like I don't have a specific home. If I'm then going to be having a head chef in each site and I'm overseeing a whole load of things, so there was that transition of just like, you know, it's time to go from one job to another job within the business. But now Brunswick's in a really good place. We don't really have to get too involved there. We've got a great team. They know what they're doing. And Jackson's going over to open Orosei, which is our third site. And I'm not having too much to do with that. but I want to be here, and I want to be here because, like I said, it's just...
It's your baby.
It is my baby. And this, you know, the core of what we do here was my idea that I'd had for a few years with, and you know, I need to see that through. And the team deserve to have a, you know, someone in place that will lead them, because I don't think I don't think they've had that yet. So yeah, it's nice to be here, definitely.
Absolutely. So was there again a moment where you kind of you created your own dish, and that's something that's kind of stood out for you, and you're like, right, I'm proud of that.
The light bulb moment when it happened.
I'm not sure. I thought about this, and I'm not necessarily sure. Back in the day, I think that using things like foraged produce was something just before Noma was on the scene, and then they started bringing it into, you know, encouraging.
Fashion, yeah.
Exactly. We were doing it, and maybe I was a little obsessed with it, a little too... my use of it was a little too much on a menu, so it was a bit too much too soon. I can't necessarily think of things I was doing with stuff, but I mean, I would have overused that, but I was very proud of overusing that.
Yeah, like deliberately.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think if there was anything I first ever did that I was kind of uniquely me, I don't know, maybe the first terrine that I made, I mean, I couldn't even think what would be in it, but certainly the first terrine where it's like, you know, being in restaurants where you're on a garnish section or something, and you know, the first bit of creativity that the chef will allow you to do is do like the soup of the day or something.
Right.
But for me, it'd be like terrines, and I would have come up with a terrine of some kind. I was, at the time, I think I really loved doing fish terrines, things kind of set in a little bit of aspect. Maybe it was the jelly deal thing.
Yeah, I think it might be.
I definitely made a jelly deal terrine once.
How did that go down?
You know, it looked good. I made it with conger eel though, and it wasn't as pleasant.
They're a bugger to kill. They're hard graft, isn't it, doing anything to do with eel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they're huge, aren't they? I mean, trying to land one on a boat is just insane.
Mental. There you go, Ben. We know what we're doing next Tuesday. Landing congas.
Hey, on the canal.
When I put a ferret down my keg.
I'm not stroking it. Come on.
Yeah, we were talking before, and I do want to dive into this. We were talking before about Pilot Light.
Yeah.
And I've heard about this since it's come out through Sean and you and stuff like that. And it's fantastic, and from being a chef and from working in kitchens from, you know, Cumbria to down here, it's something that's never talked about. Can you just like, you know, why you started it, what it is? Because we talked briefly about it before, but...
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, the simplest thing that I ever wanted Pilot Light to do was just to get people talking about mental health. As I said earlier, there's so many things that we can do with it, and the whole team are exploring all those avenues. But all I really wanted people to do is just talk about mental health. And the more we talk about it, we can encourage others to do that. And then we start breaking down that kind of taboo, that stigma that was attached to actually speaking up. So, you know, I've got an event to do this week where I'm kind of talking to 200 chefs at a conference. And I've done in November, I was doing a mental health conference, the biggest of its kind in the UK, actually. And you've got Prince William sat in front of me while I'm part of a panel, which is, you know, I never thought it'd get that far. But I guess my role in this whole thing is just talking. I just want to talk.
Starting the ball rolling, isn't it?
Exactly. And yeah, I say there's going to be a lot more that people can access through websites and a restaurant pledge. But, you know, my job really is just getting that word out and keeping that conversation happening.
So do you see more of that happening, more kind of events where you're going there and you're talking to chefs and learning about, you know, their experiences and how you can help and your own experience?
Certainly. And I think we hope that we can be doing those events as well. But I think even the narrative now, that because people know I'm attached with Pilot Light and talk about mental health, I mean, we're sitting here talking about it on a podcast. I did a podcast 2 weeks ago specifically on mental health. The fact is now it just means that I'm sure that every time someone speaks to me, a mental health thing is going to come up. And that's exactly what I want this to happen. And, you know, I've had my problems with kind of addiction and depression. But I've also put a lot of things in place in my life that allows me to make sure that I never go back to that. And I can only encourage others to either adopt the same. But I know it's not going to work for everyone. But just sharing my story may... tick of, you know, help a few people, and if even if it's just one person, then I've done something.
It's being aware as well. It's getting the awareness of it, especially in our industry. I don't think I've ever heard, and it's never talked about. It's just like chefs can be moody because they're tired. Well, why are they tired? Because they're working. Do you know what I mean? It's
well, like, I think for me, it was. I wanted to recognise there is a problem with depression, something I didn't believe in before until I had it. And then I went through what I did. I had supportive friends and family. And you know, like I said, I had a determination to get myself out of a hole. When I kind of acknowledged it on World Mental Health Day on Instagram, it just fucking blew up. And that's when I felt I needed to do something with it. Now, recognising there was a problem, it's certainly in the Western world, you know, where we put a lot of expectations in front of us and failure, you know, as soon as something does go wrong, then, you know, we're devastated. And I just, I guess that I felt that with the problems that we have in terms of depression and other mental health issues, my voice is biggest in food and this industry. I might as well start with chefs because I know there's a few chefs that have those problems, but then from there, kind of, you know, from there it can be adopted by anyone really. If we can show as an industry,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it shouldn't be exclusive to chefs or, you know, industry. It should just encourage others to speak up as well. So, you know, there's a load of people as part of the food chain that's, you know, suppliers that have spoken to me about their issues. And it's great. I mean, that is part of the restaurant industry, isn't it?
You know? Absolutely, yeah. And it's going to have such a positive impact on a lot of people. And it's almost the start of the journey, isn't it? Yeah. It's almost that you're still developing that next stage and who knows where it can go.
Yeah.
Which is the real beauty, right?
Exactly. I never wanted to own this either. I just wanted to get this conversation started. And, you know, it will be how the industry adopts it as its own, the success of it, really.
I love the chef's hands thing you did.
Yes.
That was wicked.
Joachim,
is that your idea?
It wasn't actually. It was Joachim Blockstrom, who's a really great photographer. He came to me because he just started. I think he'd taken one or two other pictures. And he said, look, can I take a picture of your hands? I'm doing this thing. And then that's where we started talking about Pilot Light. And he mentioned another chef had said to him, like, you know, if these hands could talk. And it was really about the story that that chef's hands play and, you know, what we've been through, the scars, the cuts, the burns, that kind of stuff.
The burns. I've got one at the moment. Yeah. Really horrible. And it's like, yours covering the bugger off.
So it was actually Joachim had come to me, said, look, you know, Pilot Light has a dialogue. This Chef Hand project has a dialogue. Can we put it together? And, you know, I said, yeah, absolutely. Let's do this. And he put on a little show, like a little private view in November, I think it was. And then we did some auctions and it was just so well received. And now people want to get involved and have their hands taken. And I think there's even like an industry members club that's just opened in Soho. And I know they've been asking to get some of the prints for the walls there. So
some really good ones. One guy we had on, Tom Brown's on it, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is
I was actually really surprised. I mean, all credit to Joachim for actually going and being as ballsy and just getting as many chefs on side on it. But that opened up such a big avenue of support from everyone. It was just...
And it's another thing that's continuously evolving and will evolve, you know.
Well, you know, we could think about doing a book next.
Always with the books. Yeah. Another book.
I'm not going to write this. Do you know what it was? It was more that, you know, for every photograph that got displayed, then we would write our own little notes.
That's nice.
Whether it be a paragraph or, a full page of something about our experience in a kitchen, our struggles and stuff. And that's when we started thinking about, you know, having the book where you've got, you know, the photograph one side, the dialogue the other side, and just
little coffee table book.
It would be. And that would always have some relevance as well. It's not going to be one you find in the bargain bin in Sainsbury's in a year's time. That would be around for.
Yeah, that's such a great idea. The stories behind them, you know, the things that you would never really know, would be so interesting, motivating. Yeah,
little tales from the hands. I love that. Not these ones. You've got no chance, Andrew.
Put them away. Come on,
dick fingers.
Too many ferrets.
I know. Right. Obviously, that was superb. I think talking about other places, obviously, you're opening the new place in Notting Hill next year. Well, this year, sorry. So when's that happening?
Next month.
next month. Excited?
Well, yeah, but like I say, I'm not having too much to do with it. It's a very smaller site. It's in Notting Hill. I mean, I fucking hate West London personally. but yeah, we had an opportunity to do something, and it just kind of meant that, you know, me and Jackson are at a kind of safe distance, which is kind of cool. We want to do some big things together this year, but it was easy for him to go over and do that while I just kind of, you know,
concentrate
on this. And then we've got hopefully by the end of the year we've got a couple of other little things coming up as well.
So where are some of your favorite places to go and eat and enjoy your food?
I'd love to say I eat out a lot, and I don't really eat out in the right places, or, you know, the places that I don't really pay myself much money, and therefore I feel like I'm always going on the poverty line of where to eat. So you know, little noodle bars where I can get a bowl of noodles and broth for £5. That's, you know, I'm a bit of a cheapskate. And
some of the best ways to eat, though.
Yeah,
but it is. You never get disappointed because you've only paid a fiver.
So you're absolutely right. And then I get to the point where I don't really want to cook at home, because I'm not going to go down to the shops and do all the shopping and then go back and do that. It's like, well, if I'm working like 6 days a week, I take Sundays off religiously. But, you know, any spare time I've got, then it's easier for me to go and get some noodles somewhere. And I have a couple of little haunts in Hackney that I just, you know, go and hit up. But I've got to say, some of my, you know, if I do get out, I went to Sambo Shock. Yeah, I went there for my birthday, and a Dangerous Dinner Gang.
I want this bloody WhatsApp number. I'm getting involved. We turned up, us three, outside with
there'll be no one else there.
With the microphones. We'll do your album.
It's next week. Oh, bloody hell.
And that was great. I mean, again, noodles in a spicy broth. That was delicious. Their fried chicken there is just off the hook. So I can't wait to go back and actually buy a plate of fried chicken that I can dunk in the noodles and just have that going on. I'm always at Smoke and Go. I feel like I'm there because it's just around the corner. And it's, you know, the food's great. It's
we've heard so many good things. So many people have told me about this. But yeah, it sounds great.
It's just so affordable. I mean, I don't want to say it's cheap. It's just affordable. And it's
awesome food. Really good food.
So I'd be in there two or three times a week, particularly when we was building this place. You know, the whole building work was going on so slow that
just eat and kill time.
Every day. Yeah, exactly. I have our meetings down there. So, yes.
Very nice.
Right, do you want to get into quick fire?
Quick fire, mate. Let's crack on.
Right. It is how it sounds. To be fair, it's not very quick, because we'll say something and then we'll
talk for 20 minutes.
Then you'll have a story about a ferret down some trousers.
Yeah, maybe. favorite animal down your trousers.
Right, go on, you start.
Top three foods you couldn't live without.
Noodles. Fried chicken.
Yeah.
I've said those already.
I was just thinking.
Maybe let's drop the fried chicken. Fish and chips. It's my death row meal. And then I'm going to say pie and mash.
Oh, nice.
Because, two for one.
Yeah, because pie and mash with a side of eels. I grew up on that. And I live just around the corner from Broadway Market. So I often pop in there. What is it called? I
think F-Cooks.
F-Cooks, exactly. Mm. As you know, from someone from South London, that area, we was always in Manzi's, which right. To me was like, you know, that's the one you go to. And I spent in my kind of, when I was about 18, I'd go there every lunchtime, the one on Towerbridge Road, because I was a painter and decorator, just earning some money. And I'd walk around there and go and have like double pie, double mash.
Awesome. Was it a Friday?
Yeah, go back. That was literally every day of the week. It's the cheapest thing I could eat.
Amazing.
So have you got a food guilty pleasure?
Food guilty pleasure. Now, that's where I'm going to put fried chicken in.
Yeah, yeah, that's your go-to.
It is. I mean, it's got me out of a lot of hangovers.
It's a naughty one, isn't it?
It is.
I love the way it's gone up market as well now, because I could still have them. I can have the up market and I can have the absolute pits, and so enjoying both exactly the same.
Yeah, I think there's... I don't like it when it's too refined. And I don't like it when it's too cheap. And like, you know, even though we do it to ourselves, but going into like a... Perfect fried chicken.
Yeah, one of those kind of places. PFC.
Yeah, exactly. And then they just sit like a big pile of wings on top of each other, and they just get soggy, and they're not particularly pleasant. We do it to ourselves. I love kebabs. Yeah, and
me too.
I've got to say, December, I had a few too many doner kebabs, which I'm paying heavily for now, and I'm having to train hard to get this fucking spare tire off.
I like the doner thing as well, because I get some dirty looks when I go with mates and order a doner. I'm like, well, I'm not waiting for 10 minutes. I'm having a kebab. Funny, I want it now.
Funny story. During December, I genuinely had a doner kebab on the way into work.
Wow.
It was like 11 o'clock in the morning.
Morning kebabs. I've done best Turkish in Scott Newington, and I had a morning kebab, and it put, and I couldn't have them for 2 months. So I was like, this is not, it did it for me. Cause I was like, oh, that was too much.
That's got a certain ring to it. I think you should start a place called Morning Kebabs.
They're unbelievable. Perfect. That kebab shop, best Turkish kebab in Scott Newington. It's regimented. There's 10 of them in a row. Have you seen the picture they've got on the wall?
Yeah.
With them all that. The best thing I spoke to the guy. No, there's a picture of them all on the wall. They've all got the hand on the shoulder, but they don't do a picture every time someone leaves. They just take the head out of someone and put the head in. So someone's got a Chinese hand and a Turkish face. And me and my mate just point and laugh every time. And then there's David Schwimmer with a David Schwimmer came in 1998.
Love from Ross. Yeah.
Love from Ross.
It's great. Do you see the side when they're actually first on the spit and they've just made them? They're like,
oh, they're unbelievable. Yeah.
Half a meter wide.
Yeah, at like 8 a.m. and there's a queue still. People are there, it's me and you. We're on the way to work.
Well, every now and then I just have this kind of thing where I have to eat something really shit and I'm not hungover and I'm not pissed. But I've just got to, I get it in my head that you've got to have a kebab today. And it's got to be a really good doner kebab.
Determination.
With no shame whatsoever, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that.
Well done.
Straight there.
It's always full of police as well, isn't it? Just getting there.
Of course it is. Always there, the police.
You know it's good then. Right, biggest kitchen disaster.
I think I've had so many close calls, but touch wood a lot. I've never quite had a disaster. There has been times when I've been like doing event catering for restaurant groups and, you know, it's someone's wedding, you're in the middle of a field in a big marquee.
Here we go. This always happens. You can see the light bulb moment. It comes to her and they're just like,
I know. But this wasn't necessarily, so this particular incident was not anything to do with us and we didn't make it. It was just, we were cooking at this wedding and the bride and groom had ordered a croque en bouche as their wedding cake that sat in the marquee. And then they had a live band that was in the marquee and they were doing their kind of warm up sound check. The kick drum was just boom, boom, boom. And it was a warm day.
Oh no.
And the croque en bouche took a nosedive off the table onto the floor and just went everywhere. And I remember the manager coming in saying, is anyone good with sugar work?
Jesus.
And I was like, what's up, Dave? And he's like, the croque en bouche has fallen off the table. I was like, oh, come on, what's up? And he says, it really has. So I sent someone down to the Tesco's, grabbed some sugar. We melted that down and I kind of pieced it all together. But this thing, I mean, it looked like it had been in the dishwasher, like in a washing machine or something. It had just been tumbled around. I mean, I kind of saved it, but there was no way it was ever going to look the same again.
Modern art. That's what you got to do, isn't it?
We just, you know, we spun a lot of sugar and just kind of put this nest around it to hide a lot of the detail. But I'm sure that the brother of the groom I met many years later, and we were having a laugh about it. And he said, no, they were so grateful that someone had rescued it.
Yeah.
It was kind of out of our control. Did not, and it was the second time I've ever experienced someone wanting a croque en bouche in summer for their wedding because we actually made one year. Another restaurant and left it in our PDR and it was just starting to melt and it was just like, who does this? Why would you fucking do this?
Why would you do it to yourself? Why would you put yourself through the stress?
That was it. I after that time, I was like, never again.
You're doing weddings, never do weddings. I've had some harrowing things doing weddings. First ever time I did a wedding and it was like, we just set up a catering company, me and my mate. Never catered before. You know what I mean? We were singers in a band. So we were just like, let's do it after this. Like, we went to Cumbria to learn to make sausages for 6 months, came back.
Yeah.
This guy just says to us, you got to do his wedding. It was his friend. We were like, well, we've never, ever cooked for anyone. He said, well, you could do mine. So he hired us because we were cheap and we didn't know how to cost things, right? And then we turned up, this hall started cooking, didn't realise that you could prep things the day before. So we did 150 bangers and mash. The oven broke. So In the end, they weren't bloody cooked. 3 hours late. That's 3 hours late, the food was.
Shit.
It was honestly the worst day of my life. And I went out afterwards, right? And I thought I had a can of beer and I sat on like a car kind of bonnet. And so, someone didn't see I was there and walked out and went, great wedding. Food was shit. And I just started crying. And I was like, I'm never, ever doing that again. 2 weeks later, I got myself a pop-up and I was like, oh, that's me, done now. But then you live and you learn. Learning curve catering, I was going to call it for the first 2 months. And I was like, I won't get picked up here.
We're evolving.
Yeah. But what can you do? Because they just sent it was the vicar. Obviously, it was the vicarage. So the vicar came down. He's like, oh, I know how to fix ovens. I was like, it was just a house oven for 150 sausages. Shit. It was awful, man.
I've definitely, like I say, I've had so many close scrapes and just, you know, pulled it out the bag last minute. But the story I was actually going to say before that cock and bouche story popped in my head was that I remember being at one place and you're kind of in the middle of nowhere. Again, in a marquee, you've got a generator to power the ovens. And we were doing, I don't know if it was like lamb leg. I thought it's like stuffed lamb saddles, I think they were. And it was maybe 80, 100 people. But these things are cooking in the oven and then everything goes down. The generator goes down. And again, it's out of your control. But you've got to get that food out to them one way or another. And I think we just managed to cook it to the point where instead of giving it a nice rest before having them cut and then a nice rest before going on the plate, it was literally slice on the plate, sauce, go. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was as fine as that. But I'm glad that those days are behind me. There's something about being in a restaurant where, you know, again, you are in a certain comfort zone. Things can go wrong. They do go wrong. And particularly when people don't show up to work, that's you're already on the back foot. But I think the stresses of doing outside events where you haven't got, you can't change things. Do you know what I mean?
You've got to roll with it. Yeah.
Totally done with that.
No more. If you had to eat the same meal every day, what would it be?
Pie mash. I'm not sick of that at the moment.
I've got to say, we're all going pie and mash for a long time, a bit of liquor.
You know what? That's a lie. Noodle soups. I eat so many and they are so varied. So whether it be a ramen or a pho or, you know,
a few people have said that, haven't they? A few people have been on that. I like that because it's just so, it's light. It's kind of like, but it's light and it fills you up at the same time, if you know what I mean. You can have them. I could have them every bloody day.
There's a thing about, you know, I just love things with a lot of broth and it's so restorative and it just kind of kicks you out of a hole. Also, you know, I love the chew of nice hand-pulled noodles and, you know, if it's got a bit of spice in there, I load it up with chili oil and stuff like that. But, Sambo Shock's laxas are really fucking great as well. Do you know what I mean? So they give you a little bit of a punch. So I need to get that soon. I need to go and go.
Yeah, definitely.
We need one of them.
This is our geeky question, so you can really geek out if you need to. Top three bits of kit in your kitchen you can't live without.
Well, I mean, we've got a little fireplace, which is the heart of the restaurant. That to me is just something that was inspired by a trip to La Tupina in Bordeaux, which is this old restaurant. We've got a big old fireplace and they cook things in like a cauldron of duck fat, a small little grill, a tiny little spit. And I just thought, you know, how it'd be really good to have that in a kind of bigger scale in a London restaurant. And we kind of took the fireplace idea and I drew a little frame on the back of a napkin and sent it to a friend who like literally welded it all together within 24 hours. And now we're just adding bits to it all the time. There's so many things. It's so versatile. And we haven't even had a chance yet in the kind of 8 months that we've been open to really explore what we can do with it. But I'm really excited about, you know, doing so much more to that. So, that's that. Other things in the kitchen. I mean, I feel myself a bit more traditional than the days of having all these gadgets and stuff have been and gone for me. I think we have a vac pack machine, which I use very little these days. Rationale ovens are great. I mean, at the end of the day, they're a steamer. They're a good kind of solid oven. They have a thermometer in there, so that helps. I couldn't live without them. We do try and, you know, do a little, you know, a lot of things on the fireplace, but then, you know, when we have to cook overnight, then stuff will go in the rationale and finished on the fire afterwards. So where are we? The hearth, the rationale. maybe the PacoJet, Thermomix, maybe the Thermomix. It's a bit more versatile.
Everyone loves a Thermomix, don't they?
I don't like their new ones. Their new ones are shit. They really are. They're electronic and...
We're going for a sponsorship here, Andrew. I'm joking. Imagine that.
But they are shit. They are terrible. The model they had before was just so simple. You just turned the dial and whizzed around. Now, even when you unplug them...
Try to make them fancy, aren't they?
They are making them fancy and they're shit. And they're bigger. Mm. But anyway, you unplug them now and then if you don't shut them down properly, you plug them back in and you've got to go through like this 10-step thing just to get them back up and running. It's just like, I'm
no,
a chef.
No That's, need, yeah. No
I've got time for this.
No exactly. time for this, come on.
And being small, bin. Yeah. Last question. If you could cook your favourite meal for one person, who would it be?
My favourite meal for one person? Who would it
and
be?
You can, you're cooking it, don't forget. You can eat it with him or her.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my girlfriend, isn't it, really? It has to be that.
He smashed that one out of the water. Oh, Jesus.
It has to be. If I said anyone else, I'm not really a good... As I've got older as well, I just can't be bothered to be around people. I've just become that kind of miserable old man. Just like, over Christmas, I stayed in. Like, you know, I was getting invited to a bunch of things. I was like, no, I'm just sitting in on my own. So 10 days I had like my own little home protest where I just didn't go out.
Get the guitars out.
Got the guitars out. Loads of Columbo on TV as well.
Sounds like Christmas, that, yeah.
Perfect.
So it's just like, you know, there's the people say about like, you know, what dinner party guests would you invite? I'm like, no one. I've just got to that point where I just don't tolerate people anymore. I don't really have much to say myself anymore. I'm just like, I'm tired of speaking. Like,
peace and quiet.
Exactly. My Chill girlfriend out. Can tolerate me and, you know, I love her to bits. She's good.
It's a lovely way to end. Andrew Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Cheers.
Andrew Clark, what a lovely dude.
What a great episode, what a good conversation. We talked everything from foraging, rock and roll.
Mental health in there.
Well, this is an amazing thing that he talked about with his pilot-like campaign, opening the doors to mental health awareness in the hospitality industry.
It's great to see those conversations starting to kind of come out and everyone's just getting on it and getting involved. So yeah, great episode. So you know what to do?
Like, subscribe, get involved, write a review, tell your nana, tell Ferret Man. We're out in the Ferret Man, aren't we now? So, you know, we're going from there. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you all very soon.
Ta-ta.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.